Exodus 3, 1 through 14. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And he looked, and lo, the bush was burning, and yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hittites, and Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will see you to the Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to the Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? He said, But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain. And Moses said to God, If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And now I will read from Theologians. One through three. Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy, to the church of the theologians, and God the Father, and the Lord Jesus Christ, grace to you and peace. We give thanks to God always for you all, constantly mentioning you in our prayers, remembering before our God and Father your work of faith and labor of love and steadfastness of hope in your Lord Jesus Christ.
The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. It had been a terrible few months. There was this fight going on between an Egyptian and a Hebrew, and Moses saw it and ran up and tried to break it up, but then he got involved in the fight, struck the Egyptian and knocked him down, and He died. Everybody found out about it. So he fled. He made it out of the imperial city, past the guards. He was dressed like a prince, after all. But then it was just desert. For miles and miles in every direction. And he wandered. For months. His fancy clothes got dirty. He had to find food for himself, find water. And finally, Moses came to this miserable point of self-dejection. And one long day, after he had walked 10 or 12 miles through the desert, he saw an oasis. He went there for a drink. And he thought, oh, maybe there is a God because I'm still alive after all these days in the desert. And here is this well, and I drank my fill. Maybe God has not forgotten us. Maybe God has not forsaken me. And then he saw this herd of sheep coming from a distance. The herd of sheep were shepherded by several women. And they came to the well. But just as they got there, some bandits came out, tried to drive them away. And Moses, being the same man who had objected to the injustice of his brother Hebrew being beaten by an Egyptian, that same fire stirred up in him again. He drove the bandits away, and he drew water for the sheep and for the women, watered their flock. And they went home to their father, Jethro, and they said, this incredible man warded off these bandits and watered our sheep. And Jethro said, and you left him in the desert? Go and get him. So at the end of this, by the end of this day, Moses is eating a delicious meal in a comfortable tent with people he doesn't know. And the scriptures tell us that this whole episode leads to Moses marrying one of those women, one of the daughters of Jethro, the priest of Midian. And Moses, his life, as difficult as it's been, starts to turn around. And he doesn't really know what's happening, really. But he knows that something is happening. And one day when he's out watering the sheep, pasturing the sheep by himself, he sees this thing. And he thinks to himself at first, no, that's not possible. But he looks again, and indeed it's not a mirage. There is a bush that appears to be on fire, but it's not being consumed. And so Moses says to himself, his sense of justice, you see, is ingrained in him. His sense of curiosity, I think, also is ingrained in Moses. And Moses says to himself, let me turn aside and see what this might be. And I love this moment in the scripture now. It says, when the Lord saw that Moses had turned aside, then the Lord spoke to Moses. Mark this carefully. When the Lord saw that Moses had seen and turned aside, then the Lord spoke. Moses, we know the rest of the story. Moses, the most unlikely of servants, a murderer, a wanderer, a homeless person, and yet, for all his faults, someone whose sense of justice is imprinted on his soul, someone whose sense of curiosity about life, about the openness of the future, cannot be finally eradicated from his mind. This is the wandering Jew that God chooses to save his people. So we know a little about Moses now, but what about this God? Who is this God? It's Moses' question. It's a fair question, isn't it? Who are you? I am the God of your fathers. But more than this, I am a God who has heard the suffering cry of my people. We believe in a God who listens and who speaks when and if we pay attention. God is not coercive. God does not manipulate us. God only and always invites. And that invitation always comes in the form of a call. Moses, I have chosen you. You will go and bring my people out of Egypt. But I can't do that. Who am I, says Moses. And yet, he is completely convinced by the glory of God to the point that he takes off his shoes and collapses on the ground and turns his face away. For he cannot look on the glory of God. And so, despite all of his misgivings, he responds to the call, puts his shoes back on, goes and tells his father-in-law, Jethro, and his wife, I'm off to Egypt. I'll be back. I'm going to get the people of God, the sons of Israel, for he has heard their cry. And off he goes. But he gives his life. He gives his sweat and his tears for one reason. He has faith in the God who has called and sent him. And faith in its deepest form is a response to God's own self-revelation. What do we put our faith in? Think about it. You put your faith in the things that you know are true, right? I have faith that when I put my key into the ignition of my car, it's going to turn over, and by jingo, when it doesn't, I'm riled. I have faith that even if Jessica doesn't pick up the phone when I call, if I leave a message, at some point she'll call me back when she's available, because she always does. I have faith in her. I have faith that if I throw a rock up in the air, I better get out of the way because it's coming down. Do you have faith in the one who says, I am like this? Because you know that God exists, that God is real? Have you seen a revelation of the living God that convinces you that you can go forth in ministry with absolute confidence in the one who has sent you? That's what's necessary. That's what's necessary. And so when that happens, we'll understand that everything we give of ourselves is a response. It has nothing to do with any instigation or plan of our own. It's all a response. I have a similar story of wandering in the wilderness that I'm going to tell today. I was happy singing opera. I enjoyed my career in the performing arts. I liked to travel. I liked the music. I liked the people, most of them. There were a few duds here and there, but I was probably a dud for someone else. So, but I liked it. I was happy in my musical life. I met a person who redirected my life. And I'm not telling that story today. I'm telling the story of God's presence and revelation in my life. There came a point where I got involved with a church. And I had ceased being happy in my life. And I didn't know what to do with my life. And I felt kind of lost. And for more than weeks and more than months, in fact, for years, I wandered in a kind of conundrum. And I wondered what I would do. How I would survive this unhappiness. How I would survive sensing that I had never really quite been my true self. And my pastor pulled me aside one day. And he said, do you think that you might be called to ordain ministry? And I said, nope, you're crazy. David persisted, however, and so did the associate pastor, John. They persisted, and then the congregation began to persist. And finally, David said to me, you know, we all see it, but you don't. We all see it, but you don't. So from that point on, I couldn't help but think about it. They'd all maliciously put the idea in my head. Well, months went by, and I felt something begin to change. I knew something was happening, but I didn't know what. And I didn't know if it was God. I couldn't put my finger on it. Couldn't name it right out loud. But something was happening. The problem was this, dear friends. I couldn't reconcile that God was calling me. I couldn't accept it. I didn't believe it. How can you be called to ministry if you're an idiot or a jerk or a loudmouth opera singer? Why me? You know, the Bible is populated by these kind of people, by idiots and jerks and loudmouth, well, maybe not opera singers, but what's your version of loudmouth in the Bible, right? Moses is the Hebrew prince of an Egyptian, Hebrew adopted son of an Egyptian princess. He's an idiot and a jerk. I remember I was working at a restaurant. I was teaching music at a university part-time. And during the summers, the session was off, so I waited tables at a very nice restaurant. I made a lot of money doing it. And I was off one day, and I was at home. I was by myself. And I thought, I'll just lie down for a minute. And this was a point in the summer where I had even come to the point of applying to go to seminary. I'd written the application and the essay and filled out the financial assistance package and sent it all in. And they had sent back a note. Yes, you're accepted. We'd love to have you. Come in the fall. Well, I got the heebie-jeebies, and I said, no, actually, I take it back. And I told him I didn't want to come, and I turned down my acceptance. They'd given me a full scholarship. This was Vanderbilt University. Well, that was May, and this day off in July, it was quiet. The house was shut up because, you know, in Tennessee in July, you can't open the windows. It was very quiet. And I was lying on my bed, and I thought, I'll have a nap. But I couldn't go to sleep. And then, however you want to describe this, either I said to myself or somebody through my own conscience said to me, get up, go to Vanderbilt, and fix this. And I was lying down on the bed. And I sat bolt upright. And I put my feet out of the bed. And in the silence, I said, this is very strange. Let me go and see what this is about. And when the Lord saw that I had turned aside, the Lord spoke. I went to Vanderbilt that day. I got up, got dressed, got in my car, drove downtown. It was the middle of the summer. Nobody was there except the one person who could help me. The director of the United Methodist Studies program. Tom said to me, oh, Jonathan, what are you doing here in the middle of July? Are you coming to school this fall? Well, I don't know, Tom, how much time do you have? Tom gave me Tom had come to check his mail, gave me 2 hours of his time. We sat there, we talked. He called the director of admissions on her private home line, told her what was happening. She said, I'm on maternity leave, but I'll be back next Monday from maternity leave. Okay, Jonathan's coming to see you. I went next Monday. Catherine said, what's this I hear? You turned us down and now you want back in? She was going to give me a hard time. And she said, of course you can have your acceptance back, but I've got to call the dean about this scholarship. So Catherine, the director of admissions, associate dean of the school, called the dean of the Divinity School of Vanderbilt University on his private line at his family cottage in Missouri and said, Jonathan has finally figured out that he's called to ministry. Can he have his scholarship back? Yep, fine. When I turned aside to look, to listen, God spoke and revealed himself in a way that I could not deny. The signs were all there. And deeply and most meaningfully for me, it was the God who has said to all the world, I have heard the cry of your misery, and I have come down to deliver you. The God revealed in the burning bush is none other than the God who hangs on this cross. And the words are the same. I have heard your cry of misery, and I have come down to deliver you. Now go and save my people. When we have a moment of revelation like this, when we fully perceive the meaning of the cross, that God has not left us here to die, then what is giving but the outward sign of faith? Do you know what a sacrament is? The word sacrament is the Latin word for sign, sacramentum. It means sign. And the bread and the wine are the sign, the sacramentum, the body and blood of Christ. They make material that which is immaterial. They make outward that which is inward. That's what a sacrament is. And this mystery is not confined to this table or this font. God makes material what is spiritual all the time in various ways. We have to stop and look and see the signs, see the sacraments of God's presence. And so I want to introduce to you today that when we give of our material wealth, it is and becomes and must be the sacrament of our faith, the sign of our faith, that which makes material the inward and spiritual truth that we have seen God and turned aside and been called and sent. If every nickel and dime and penny and piece of paper and bank slip and check, if these things aren't the outward sign of an inward grace, we have not yet understood what it means to give. But when we understand, the joy of our lives overflows because we understand in the midst of our fear that God is with us. That's what he says to Moses. I am with you. And so Paul says to the Thessalonians, I rejoice always for your work of faith. What is a work of faith? It's not just the act of believing. A work of faith are all those things we do that make manifest the inward grace of our trust in God. That's what giving is. And so, like the church of the Thessalonians, let us have a work of faith. For we are all called, we are all sent. We are all God's people, and he has come down to to deliver us. Thanks be to God.